Great. All right, without further ado, the reason why we're all here this evening, Gil M. from Oceano.
Hi, I'm Gil, I'm an alcoholic. And thanks for asking me to share, Brendan. And it's good to see everybody here, and good to see you guys here at the rooting, cheering section, I guess. I don't know. Yeah. But, yeah, you know, life is good today because I'm sober. And, you know, for those of you, all the newcomers, welcome. You know, this might seem really weird to you. In fact, it still seems kind of weird to me even after all these years. But, you know, I think we heard from the people who celebrated 1 year, you know, Anthony and Tom, that biggest thing was that it was all of us. It was, you know, you could talk about the steps, you could talk about, you know, higher power, you could talk about all these things, but the biggest thing is that they made a connection with other people. And ultimately that's what it comes down to, is that, you know, it seems weird until you make the connection with other people, and then it starts to feel more normal. And you know, I didn't realize how weird I was when I was drinking and using. Now I'm kind of weird now that I'm sober, okay, but I didn't realize how weird I was when I was drinking and using. Because it seemed normal, you know, it really did, and I couldn't see it in myself, you know. And you know, and it talks about that in the big book too. It says, you know, that the alcoholic can't differentiate the true from the false. And I had a lot of really good ideas when I was out there drinking. And, yeah, I see some of you had some good ideas too, right? And you know, looking back at it, it's like, man, what was I thinking, you know? And It's just such a trip, you know. You know, sometimes I wonder, you know, now that I've been sober, I got sober in 1991 up in San Francisco. And, you know, I look back at some of my thinking, it's like, how could I think like that? And then I'll talk to someone who's like kind of half in, half out the program, and they'll have some of the similar ideas I used to have. And I'm like, what are they thinking? And it's like, oh yeah, that's how I used to think, you know, I get it. So anyway, really great to be here. You know, this is a really cool club. It kind of reminds me of where I got sober up in San Francisco. It used to be this little place called 1010 Valencia. Had carpets just like this, had old chairs. You know, this looks like there should be smoke on the wall, you know, because I used to have all this smoke, and you can kind of, it's kind of coming through the paint. You can kind of see it. So this is very similar to like where I got sober up in the city, and same kind of people. It was like down in the Mission, so you had rich people, poor people, gangbangers, homeless, Irish mafia, everybody. And we'd all mix. And you talk about people don't normally mix. You know, nobody really ever got in fights or anything. You know, every now and then there'd be some kind of really crazy person and you'd have to ask him to leave. But other than that, nobody ever really got permanently kicked out. You know, if they wanted to come back and behave, they're always welcome, you know. And that was always an interesting place. And yeah. So, anyway, I'm never always really sure what I'm going to share when I share, so I just kind of ask God to kind of make me a channel, and what comes out kind of comes out, you know. You know, I'm not one of these circuit speakers, so, you know, if you're looking for a message of great depth and weight, you may not get it. Sorry. You know, you got me. So, you know, it is what it is, you know. So, but my story is, I was born in San Francisco. I was adopted, born in General Hospital, and always felt different right from the beginning, as long as I can remember. Never felt like I fit in. Now, I don't know if that's like part of alcoholism or not. I think a lot of people feel like they don't fit in, but eventually they grow out of it. For me, the way I grew out of it was when I was about 14 or 15, I found alcohol. And the first time I got drunk, it was just total puke, blackout, wake up in the bushes. I was with a bunch of friends. It was over the summer. And, you know, I grew up in the city, so everybody grew up riding the bus. You know, back then, you know, 60s, 70s, you know, nobody really cared about what you did when you were a kid. You know, you just had to be home at dinner and later on just be home sometime that night, you know, and try not to get into trouble. That was a big thing. And don't mess up at school, and nobody really cared. So, you know, I knew how to do those things, and so I ended up with a bunch of guys partying, and we were waiting at the bus stop, and I started throwing up, and they decided, well, Gil, you're not going anywhere for a while, we'll see you later, and they got on the bus and left me, and then there were some bushes there, so I crawled into those, and woke up a few hours later with the sun going into the Pacific Ocean and walking on the beach with puke all over me going, this is great. I want to do this again. I want to do this again tomorrow, you know? And that's kind of how I drank, you know? I was kind of a messy drunk, you know? And I used to think I was a happy drunk. Looking back, I'm not so sure, especially talking to some people, you know, when I was doing the amends thing. It was like I may not have been as happy as I thought, but in my mind, I was always kind of happy. Yeah. So my drinking started in high school, and, you know, I'd been a pretty good student, and, you know, extracurricular activities. I used to do a lot of, like, volunteer work and stuff out in the community and stuff, and that all kind of went away, you know. I used to play music. That became less important. I could still play, but my music abilities went way downhill as I drank, you know. And by the time I'm a senior in high school, I'm drinking every day, getting high every day, and just looking forward to graduate so I could just, you know, move out and do it all the time. That was my goal, just to graduate, move out, and just drink and get high all day. That's all I wanted to really do, you know. And, you know, toward the end of that senior year, I ended up drinking out by the Presidio. They have these big cliffs there, you know, and you're supposed to stay away from them. And anyway, that day I wasn't staying away from them, and I ended up falling off this cliff and breaking a bunch of bones and end up getting a helicopter to take me to the hospital. Yeah, so I do have a helicopter story. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's funny, you know, when I was drinking, man, sometimes it was so crazy. I would have all these crazy stories. Like, I used to think I'd be like Charles Bronson, you know, flying a helicopter and rescuing people out of prison and stuff. And that's the closest I ever got to a helicopter, is I got rescued and taken to the hospital from falling off a cliff. But, yeah. And so, you know, so anyway, I remember the guy in the, even, you know, I mean, I already knew the line at 17, you know, that the alcoholics use. They wheel me up in the helicopter, and the medic's there, and he's asking me, hey, have you had anything to drink? And of course, I give the alcoholic response, no. He goes, no, you got to be honest with me, okay? Because, I mean, I had a lot to drink. Come on, you know, you don't fall off a cliff by accident, you know? And so he says, no, you got to be honest with me, because I'm going to give you some medicine here, and, you know, I need to know how much you've been drinking. So I said, oh, you know, one, maybe two. Boom. So I'm out. You know, I wake up in the operating room, you know. So I don't know. Hopefully he was alcoholic, so he knew I was lying, you know. But, yeah, and that was always my thing. Every time I asked, have you been drinking? Yeah, one, maybe two. I always hated it the next day when something happened and they would ask me, have you been drinking? It's like, yeah, but, you know, and then they just roll their eyes. It was just, you know, that look. But so anyway, I recovered from that pretty good. And, you know, up until then, my drinking, I always tell them, I'm going to drink when I'm happy and I'm in a good mood. And then that summer, it kind of changed. I started drinking to change my mood because I was being unhappy. So I knew if I was unhappy, alcohol would change how I feel. So I started drinking to change how I felt. And I'm still drinking like every day and trying to go to college, but it's not really working too well. So I come up with this great idea. It's like, let's go join the Army. Because, you know, how hard can the Army be, right? And you could probably drink every day in the Army. That was my thinking, right? That was the only reason why I joined the Army, because I wanted to drink every day. I thought you drink every day in the Army. And then I end up in basic training. You don't drink at all in basic training. That was, like, horrible. And I remember the drill sergeant saying, you know, for some of you, this is going to be the first time in your life you ever have this experience of not drinking for a certain period. And he says, for the rest of you, it's going to be the last time. I'm thinking, good, I intend to be that second part, you know. And as soon as we were done with basic, man, the party was on again. I mean, I didn't even make it through basic. I snuck off, got drunk, didn't get in trouble. Other people got caught, but, you know, me and my friends, we were smarter than them, right? We're just lucky, you know, but we always thought we were smarter when we were drinking. And, you know, all the trouble I got in the Army was directly related to drinking, you know? I mean, they had a good program laid out for me, you know? They had me going to air defense school and stuff, and I barely made it out of air defense school because of my drinking. And it wasn't that I was failing, it was I would do these stupid things and get in trouble, you know, and there always be a thing, were you drinking? Well, one or two, you know, and yeah, one or two. I don't know where we come up with that, you know, it's like, but it's like, yeah, everybody knew it wasn't one or two, except me. I thought it was one or two. I didn't see what the problem was. So, you know, I ended up over in Germany, and I wasn't even there like a week, and they took away my liquor rations because my drinking was, you know, I had these liquor rations back then in the 80s where everything was rationed. You got rationed for cigarettes, you got rationed for alcohol, a couple other things, and They took away my alcohol rations with 1 week. And that was like terrible, man. It was like, how can you do that? And then the next year came around, they didn't even ask if I wanted it. They took it away when they gave it to me. It was like, man, it was so unfair, you know? And like, but see, I could never see that I had a problem with alcohol. It was like you. It was the army. It was the rules. I didn't want to follow the rules. So I guess I kind of realized too late the army had rules, you know, and that they expect you to be up at a certain time and do certain things. And it really kind of made it difficult to drink the way I wanted to, because I wanted to drink all the time, you know, and they kind of wanted you to be sober when you're on duty, you know. And it's like, so anyway, the army didn't really work out too well. You know, I got in a lot of trouble, and finally I decided, you know, me and my friend decided, you know what, let's just get out of here. So we went and made our own travel orders, and we ended up going to New York City. That was good. That was a geographic for sure, you know. So we're living in New York City, and, you know, I'm there like about a week, and I haven't gotten drunk. I said, that was the answer. Moved to New York City. Wow, you know. And that night I got blackout drunk, so the party was on again. And, you know, I stayed there for about 6 months. And, you know, it was kind of a dark period, I guess, you know, but it was kind of fun. It was exciting, you know. You know, it was like 81, 82, like all the clubs in the South, out in the East Village were there, you know, EBGB and the Mud Clubs. I felt like, oh, we're like the Talking Heads, you know, we're here, you know, these clubs. But really it was just a lot of drinking and using and getting high. And, you know, that's pretty much how my drinking went. You know, eventually I came back to California, got out of the Army, and just continued to drink and use for like, you know, until I was 30. By the time I'm 30, I'm married, I got a son. I've been, last 5 years of my drinking, I really tried, from 25 to 30, I did not enjoy my drinking at all. You know, and every day I said, I don't want to drink anymore, I'm just not happy. So I tried to stay real busy. That was like one of the ways I tried to control my drinking. It didn't work, but I tried it, you know. And by the time I'm 30, I'm just done, you know, and just figure, you know, I don't really see any way out, you know. I just want to kill myself every day. I wake up, you know, and you know, last night of my drinking, you know, I just wanted to die. I wanted to kill anybody I knew, but then I also wanted to die. And it was just miserable, you know. I couldn't even sleep. I'd have these horrible nightmares. And I'm 30 years old, you know, and I got a good job because I was very busy. By staying busy, I went back to school and I actually got a good job out of it. And but everything is wrong. That was kind of my way of looking at it. You were wrong, the job is wrong, nobody understood me. You know, they say some of us have like a hamster going through our head, a little hamster wheel. I don't know. I don't have a hamster. I got a cage full of monkeys and they're always throwing shit, you know. And yeah, so if you got the hamster wheel, I'm like, right on, man, you know, love to have that. So anyway, my cage full of monkeys is throwing all this shit here, and you know, it's just another morning of drunk. My wife is disgusted with me, but she isn't getting mad this morning, and she's just like, you know, maybe you ought to do something about your drinking, but I don't care anymore, she said. And she took my son, so I'm taking Michael, my son, I'm leaving. And I don't know, it's just like, it wasn't the worst drunk, it wasn't the worst thing that ever happened, but it was just, I don't know, I guess I was done, or maybe I didn't know what was going on, but, it, you know, I picked up the phone and started calling numbers in the phone book. It was a Sunday morning, and usually Sunday morning, the only people that answer the phone is Alcoholics Anonymous. And the guy on the phone, he said, you know, didn't say put the plug in the jug or anything, he just said, hey, it can make you happy, and he didn't tell me how. So I'm like, all right, well, I'll check out one of these meetings. So he gave me a beginner's meeting to go to that day. And I remember driving to that meeting thinking, you know, I wonder when I should get there. Should I get there on time or should I get there a little late? You know, and I wonder, are they going to know I'm new? And then I'm wondering, he said I didn't have to introduce myself when I walked in there, just go sit in there. Okay. And I was actually expecting him to practice drinking, actually. I thought it'd be kind of a club like this. We'd have a little room in the back, and after the meeting, or maybe during the meeting, we'd practice drinking, because it's Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, you probably want to practice drinking if you're an alcoholic, because that was my idea. I thought, gee, if I could just get it just right, you know? I mean, whatever the number is, you know, the number changes, you know? You know? I had a rule for driving. I wouldn't drive if I drank more than 6 beers in like 3 hours, but I don't know if I always followed that rule, you know. But, you know, I grew up in the city, so it was like you always take a taxi or a bus. So, you know, toward the end of my drinking, it was always kind of a drag trying to find the car the next day. Because I couldn't always remember where I parked it. Because, you know, sometimes I parked it before I really started drinking. So that, you know, it's not so bad if you're drunk and you can remember where it is. But when you mix those things up like that, it's very confusing to find your car. And you're not really sure where it is because the city's big. And I would go all over the city. You know, I didn't have a home bar, you know. It was like, you know. So anyway, I go to my first meeting that day, and there's no drinking there. And the lady who's sharing, she's crying through the whole meeting, which I actually thought was pretty cool because she said she was 6 years sober, and she's crying through the whole meeting. I'm like, wow, that's kind of cool. You can cry and make sense. I was really impressed by that, you know. That really impressed me. And, you know, some people shared after the meeting, and, you know, they figured out I was a newcomer because everybody came up and talked to me afterwards and told me it's going to be okay and, you know, gave me some numbers. And they gave me this little pamphlet for newcomers that was not an official AA pamphlet, but it said that AA has worked for thousands of men and women and can work for me. But that I ought to get used to doing it AA's way because they're not going to change it for me, which I thought was a little arrogant, you know, that I'm kind of special. So that's how I got into AA, you know. That meeting was weird. It felt like somebody had dropped like this giant rock on me and I'd been, you know, split to a million pieces. And I remember going out to the beach, having a hamburger and watching the sunset. And, you know, years later I reflected on that. So that was the first time in a long time I'd actually gone out to the beach and not had like a drink or a drug or something while the sunset. Because I always had to have something to enhance it, you know. I was just sitting there with a hamburger watching the sunset, and I hadn't done that in forever, you know. And yeah, I didn't really realize that until later. So, you know, I kind of got involved in this in AA right away. I didn't really know anything about AA, honestly, you know. And you have this place in San Francisco called the Dry Dock. And somebody said, yeah, you should go to the Dry Dock. So I'm like, great, I know where the Dry Dock is. It used to be this bar called the Dry Dock out by the shipyards and, off of 3rd Street. And so I go out to 3rd Street to go to this meeting, and there's no meeting, man. It's closed. I'm like, what is this, you know? And then I happen to have a schedule. I looked at it. It's actually on the other side of town. It's actually not a bar. It's actually a recovery club. And
the Dry Dock.
Yeah, I don't know why they name them the same thing, but anyway. So anyway, you know, it's kind of funny. I know where all the bars are, you know, and now it's like when I find things, it's like I kind of find them by the coffee shops or the meeting places, you know. It's like, oh, it's the store next to the Starbucks, or it's the store next to, like, you know, the May meeting place or something. But back then, everything all was bars, you know. It's next to that bar, you know. Oh, I know where that is. It could be a bar I never went into, but I knew where it was, you know. And so anyway, so that's the start of my journey of sobriety. You know, I got a big book early on. I used to have these 10 o'clock meetings, and this guy tricked me into going to 10 o'clock meetings. He said, you know, you're a young guy. I was 30 years old. So you're a young, good-looking guy. And it was down in this part of San Francisco called the Marina, which is a very nice area. And they had these, like, these three bars right in the corners there. They call it the Bermuda Triangle, I guess because people would get drunk and get lost and you wouldn't see them for days, you know. But there were a lot of good-looking women because it's a marina. They're all looking, you know, for like a rich husband, you know. And so this guy says, yeah, you know, you ought to come down to this meeting at the Dry Dock at 10 o'clock. He says, every night there's all these women. They get tired of looking for the guys in the bar. And some of them are very rich. And they come into this 10 o'clock meeting and they're looking for a nice, good-looking young guy like you to take care of. I'm like, really? So I was there every 10 o'clock meeting for like 6 months, man. You know, I never met her. No one ever took care of me, but I was there, man. I was looking, you know? And, and you know, as a result of that, I started to go meet people in AA. You know, people at the 10 o'clock meeting, they say, hey, let's go out and we'll go grab coffee afterwards. Let's get something to eat. And that's when I first started, you know, meeting people because, you know, I'm not really a morning person or a day person. I'm a night person. And so going to a 10 o'clock meeting was just perfect because now I was meeting my people and, you know, we're all young, we're all in our 20s and 30s, having a good time going out and just being really crazy, you know. And I thought some of these people are crazier than the people I knew when I was drinking, you know. And I think a couple times we even got kicked out of a restaurant, you know. It's like just we're too loud and noisy and rowdy. You guys got to go. We're like, geez, you know. And You know, and that's how that was my introduction to AA, and I started going to a lot of meetings. And you know, somebody told me early on, they said, Gil, for most alcoholics, recommend 90 meetings in 90 days, but alcoholic of my type might want to try 290 meetings in 90 days. You might have a chance. And I thought, all right, I don't know what else to do, you know. And I started going to a lot of meetings. And by going to a lot of meetings, I met a lot of people. And I met my first sponsor, and he was a very hard guy. His name was Len W. And he was the kind of guy that, I mean, I asked him if he would sponsor me. He said he didn't have time, but if I wanted to work the steps, he would help me, you know. And he did, you know, but he was mean. He would hang up the phone on me. I would call him up, and he'd say, hey, you need to do this. I was like, why? And he would hang up the phone. It's like he didn't answer the question, you know. I'd call him back. He'd hang up again. Like, how do you know it was me? He'd just hang up, you know. It was like so rude, you know. But, you know, Len really helped me. I did need a kinder, gentler sponsor. This guy had all the answers, you know. I had a lot of crazy stuff going on up here. And you know what I was always looking for was relief. Looking for relief from this because, you know, my disease isn't so much like just because when I drink, I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, if that's all it was, if I knew that, hey, Gil, you drink alcohol, you don't know what's going to happen. Okay, don't drink alcohol. That's easy, right? But the problem is I have this other part of me, this mental obsession. It says I got to have relief from this, from the monkeys and the, you know. And it says it'll be different this time when I drink. It'll be different, you know. It's going to be okay. So I try it again, you know. And I try it again, and I try it again. And it's different, but it's never good, you know. And, you know, toward the end, man, I didn't know where I was going to wake up. I mean, one time I woke up in a forest. I'm like, where the hell is this, you know. Yeah, actually turns out there's a forest in San Francisco. Who knew, right, you know? And it wasn't a park. And I'm like, shit. So yeah, I never knew where I was going to wake up, you know? I might wake up in your doorway, you know? I mean, because, you know, it's, I don't know how that happened, you know? I mean, I was leaving the bar, and next thing I know, I'm waking up in somebody's doorway. I'm not really sure how that happens. But, you know, this stuff would happen more and more, you know? And the worst is waking up someplace where you think you're on your own bed and you're not. You're like, oh, shit, you know, how to get out of here, you know. You know, just, you know, those things kind of become demoralizing after a while. And, you know, to the point where just, you know, just feel like there's no hope, you know. So if all AA offered was just don't drink, I don't think it would work, you know. But AA offered me a solution. They said through the 12 steps, you'll get relief, you know. And that's what I was looking for, relief, you know. And so my first sponsor, you know, he's a man of action, you know. You know, I'd seen the 12 steps on the wall. I was reading the big book. But I couldn't understand step 3. You know, every time somebody told me about God, I said, well, this is what God is. Okay. You know, and I came here to AA and asked people, so what is this God as you understand him, right? And nobody would give me an answer. Or everybody would give me a different answer. And I was getting very confused, you know. And finally people said, that's what a sponsor can help you with. And so that's what Len helped me understand. He says, it's God of my understanding. He says, take that we and change it to I. And I thought, wow, you know, I don't know. I don't know what I think about God. Because I only knew what everybody else told me. And so I had to kind of like find my own kind of higher power. So I just started out, I'd watch the ocean. I'd sit and watch the ocean. I said, that's a power greater than myself. You know, I'm sitting there in the ocean, watching it goes on forever. I could say, okay, that's a power greater than myself. And from there, I could kind of let it grow into like something what it is today, you know? You know, I could see that the group was a power greater than myself. Here's a group of people that had solved the problem that I didn't even have an idea. And then a lot of people seemed happy. And I was having fun hanging out with these people too when I went to that 10 o'clock meeting afterwards, you know? And I started to look forward to going to that, you know? Not for her, but to go hang out with the people afterwards, you know? And so, you know, that's kind of how my God and my understanding came. And today it's still kind of the same. It's kind of mysterious. Today it's different, but it's almost like a God beyond my understanding. I just know there is a God. I'm not it. And that, you know, I experience it in the rooms of AA and through other people, you know. My sponsor was also kind of tricky, too. He says, while we're working on the third step, we're going to have to start doing your fourth step. So you'll be ready to do your fourth step, right? So kind of sneaky, you know, because, you know, I was writing out my inventory. And really, if you're writing out your inventory, you've probably done step three, even though you didn't know it. And so he got me going on the step four. There were a lot of really good, like, workshops back then. And I started doing the inventory. And I mean, I just do it right out of the big book, the columns. You know, I do the columns, you know, I'm resentful at, the cause, what it affects. And then where I get the real like relief is looking at my part in that fourth column, where I can see where I was selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. And it just got to be where I could just see my part really quick. And then, you know, doing the fear list, and then the fear prayer, and the sex inventory, and the sex prayers, and all that kind of stuff. It really kind of really helped me kind of see what's going on. And so I wrote out this really big, long inventory, and I didn't want to share it with anybody. I was afraid to share it, actually, because there was a lot of stuff I was ashamed of in there. And so I hid it. You know, I wasn't going to share this with anybody. And what happened was, after a couple months, started to become very irritable, discontent, started thinking about suicide again, wanted to just, you know, didn't know what I was going on. It's just like I was drinking, except, you know, I wasn't drinking. You know, the feeling you get when we don't drink, how we just kind of go nuts, that's how it felt, you know? And so I said, well, you know, I haven't done this fifth step, you know, so I was trying to avoid it. And I think a lot of us try to avoid it. So I finally had two people I thought about. And so one of them was this guy I saw at the meeting all the time. And I didn't like him when I first met him. But he'd always show up at the Sunday morning meeting I went to. And when I became coffee maker, he volunteered to help me make coffee. I think I was only like 90 days sober. And I guess he wanted to make sure the coffee got done, you know. But but anyway, I started to know him. He used to share things with me. And one day he's sharing some stuff with me. I thought, man, I wouldn't even share that with somebody if I was drinking, man. Oh, my God, you know. And so he's the guy I chose to do my fifth step with, you know. And, you know, we started out, he had me meet him in a coffee shop. And it was kind of weird because I thought, why are we meeting in a coffee shop? I always heard you go private, you know. Like, but he said, I want to meet you in a coffee shop. So I'm starting to read him the stuff. And, you know, the first parts of it aren't that bad, you know. I'm resentful at this person, they did this and that. But it's starting to get a little more juicy, right? So I'm asking him, we're going to, like, want me to continue? He goes, yeah, keep going. I'm like, there's more people coming to this coffee shop. And finally got the point, like that, Ted, I can't go on, man. This is like, you know, I'm not going to share this here. So I said, okay, let's go back to my apartment. It's right around the corner. So I asked him, what was that all about, man, you know? He said, I just wanted to see if you did an honest fifth step, because if you read the whole thing in the coffee shop, he's going to tell you it wasn't honest. I'm like, oh, man, you suck, man. But, you know, the stuff, when I got to the stuff that was really juicy, that I thought was oh so shameful and terrible, two things happened. One, he fell asleep a couple times. And then the other thing was, he would say, oh, yeah, you know, I did that too, and let me share my experience with that with you. And he'd share it with me. I was like, holy shit, you know? It's like, I think I'm so different. And he's sharing the stuff that I am so ashamed of, but he did the same thing. But he's got a different perspective on it because he's been through the steps. And so now I have a different perspective on it too. And you know, when I finished that first really big fifth step, I mean, it just felt like taking a big ball of X-lax spiritually, you know? I felt so light. It was like, wow, what the hell is that, you know? And that was probably the scariest thing I ever did was that fifth step. I was so scared to do that, but it was the best thing I ever did, you know? And, you know, one thing about the steps is I come to realize they're all written in the past. So it basically means other people have already done this. So if you're scared to do the fifth step, probably the person that you're going to go find or ask to share with them, they were probably scared when they did their fifth step too. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, feel the fear and do it anyway kind of thing, you know? And, you know, we don't have to let fear rule our lives anymore. And my big fear was just my shame. And it was like, shame is like not like guilt. You know, guilt just, you know, you did something wrong, but shame says there's something wrong with me. And I can let go of that shame, you know, and it's really good. So, you know, just kind of going through the rest of the steps, you know, 6 and 7 weren't that big a deal when I was new, but they became a bigger deal later on, you know, because my character defects, they keep reoccurring. And the cool thing about my character defects is I think they're assets. I think like I'm helping you with my defects, right? And other people get really upset at some of my defects that I think are assets, and they let me know about it. And, you know, then I have to take inventory. I'm like, why are they upset at me, you know? And then, you know, 8 and 9, I think that's a lifetime job. You know, I tried to be as thorough as I could in the first couple of years, but, you know, I think it's something that you never know when it's going to happen. And some of the things are kind of funny with the 9th step. You know, like, I remember there's the one guy at high school, I thought I'd ruined his life. I really did. I thought I had ruined this guy's life. And I'm like 7 years sober. I go to my 20th reunion, and there he is. So I want to go talk to him and say, hey, you know, I'm really sorry I did this stuff. And he was doing really well. And he says, you know, I'm sorry, but I don't remember you at all. Are you kidding me? You don't remember? Somebody goes, let it go, you know? Don't need to harm others. He's really successful and happy, so I don't know what happened, man, you know? So I guess, you know, some of these things, we imagine we've done these terrible things, and that's not as bad. And some things we have done, and, it's the things that we don't realize that we've done wrong that take a long time to fill. Like, I didn't realize how much I'd harmed my family. I was like, I'm just drinking. Who am I hurting, right? And I didn't realize I was never there. I always had excuses why I couldn't show up at family functions. Or if I did show up, I'd be drunk. And, you know, toward the end of my drinking, so many times, like, people in my family, I look back now, they were asking me, hey, you know, are you going to, like, be sober? Or we're really worried about your drinking, blah, blah, blah. Because I just played it off, like, whatever. You know, you're a wuss, whatever. You don't get it, you know? And I look back now, man, I really harmed a lot of people without even knowing it. You know, just thinking, I'm not hurting anybody. And so being sober, those kind of events take years to respond before the family really starts to trust me. And, you know, today, you know, the family does trust me. They look forward to me. You know, my sister, I have a younger sister, and, like, you know, she was telling somebody a few years ago, it's like, Gil, I count on him. He's the only one in the family I can count on. I'm like, whoa, where'd that come from, you know? I never was there before, you know. So you don't know how much you hurt. But, you know, I think that recovery is progressive. just like my disease is progressive, recovery is progressive too. And I never really know, you know, all the people I touch, you know. And you never really know all the people you touch from your share. So, you know, one of the weird things too is, like, you know, the longer I stay sober, the more I realize that, you know, I guess long-term sobriety is a trip, you know, because it's like, I used to look at people that had 15, 20 years, think, oh man, you know, they got it made. They must have it all balanced, you know, and there's still lessons to be learned, you know. I was like 15 years sober, and I'm at work, and I am in big conflict with this guy. I mean, we are conflict, and, like, we're both, like, you know, this associate distribution engineer title, you know, and I know what I'm doing. He knows what he's doing. But he's got a little more seniority, right? So they say, well, you have to do what he tells you to do. And so he's telling me to do some things I think they're really dumb. So I talk to some other people, and they agree with him. What he's telling me is really dumb, right? So I'm not going to do it. Well, anyway, our boss didn't like that. I didn't want to do what he didn't want to do. So we're in the boss's office, like, twice a week. Got the union rep involved. It's going on back and forth. And, of course, you know, I'm taking inventory, but, you know, I'm right, you know. It's one of those, you know, that's a tricky thing about being sober a while, is you can take inventory, but if you're, like, still convinced that you're right, you're not really taking your own inventory. I'm still taking his inventory and not even knowing it. I can see where he's selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and right. I got that, you know. I see where he's wrong, you know. And, you know, I'm going to pray for him, too, you know, son of a bitch. But, so anyway, this is going on for, like, a couple months, and I'm sharing about it at meetings. And afterwards, somebody comes up to me after the meeting and says, you know, I know what you're going through because I used to work the same place you worked, you know. And she says, but have you ever just tried doing what he asked you to do? No, why would I do that? Well, why don't you try that? Like, okay. So I tried it. And guess what? It worked great, you know. And we actually became good friends, you know. And then, you know, I didn't have to take any more inventory and stuff. But I could just, like... Wow, who knew? If you just do what people ask you to do at work, you get along with them, you know? So I took like 15 years to learn, you know? And, yeah, so I used to think I was this model employee, and I realized maybe not, you know? You know what, you know, another challenge too is, you know, when I got here, my son, he was 5, and I was 34. And, he followed in my footsteps, but he took a little longer. He didn't start drinking until he was like 19. And first time he gets drunk, he's down at Mardi Gras. And he's calling me, "Dad, I'm drinking beer. And this is great." Click. I'm like, wow. You know, and I thought, you know, is that a normal response to someone first time they get drunk? Probably not, you know. And so he's one of us, and he's gone through the whole gamut. And, you know, I'm just visiting him. It's kind of a challenge. You know, I do Al-Anon too. And it really helps me to, you know, kind of stick to my side of the street. I didn't ask him, "Are you going to meetings? Are you planning to go to meetings?" No, I didn't say that. I just enjoy his company, you know, and he does what he does. And it's really none of my business, you know, what he does with his life, you know. So, so, you know, life is good. You know, what I've done to stay sober besides the steps, I stay very active in service, always have a commitment. You know, try to work with others, you know. And working with others isn't always like working the steps. Sometimes just hanging out, going to coffee, doing stuff, you know. Always try to have a commitment outside the group. first like 13 years, I do a lot of hospitals and institutions, take the message into like, you know, prisons and jails and mental institutions. And I really enjoyed that. And sometimes you go to a mental institution, there's not a whole lot of response coming back from the other side. But the good thing is I always know one person's going to walk out of there sober. And that was good. And then, you know, sometimes you meet the people who are in those places and, you know, they remind you, "Oh, man, I remember I saw you there." Not always, and most of the time not, you know. And then I did general service for about 10 years, and that was fun. And then recently kind of my service is more like outside the group, kind of doing like events and conventions and stuff like that. So, you know, there's always more to do, you know, kind of serve on the intergroup up in San Luis Obispo, like their literature chair, and I do that. So there's always more to do. And I don't know, I'm kind of running out of stuff to talk about. So anyway, grateful to be sober. Hope you got something out of this. And thanks.